Race of My Life, presented by Autosport.
I've always said that I never had any dreams or ambitions to win the Indy 500, or even to race an IndyCar or anything like that. I've always concentrated on what I was doing today. Just try your best to do what you're doing and the rest of it will come. If I ever had any dream about racing, it was to win a race by passing one of the top guys in whatever type of car I was racing on the last corner of the last lap. That was a dream I had many times, and there was an IndyCar race at Michigan in 1981 where it happened. It was a 150-mile race and I passed Mario Andretti on the last lap to win, just as I dreamed about. We had a good race and he was a hero of mine. I mean, Mario Andretti, there was a guy to beat on the last lap. These are the words of IndyCar legend Rick Mears describing his thoughts on his famous victory over Andretti at Michigan in 1981. This event, which featured as the four-time Indy 500 winner's pick to Autosport magazine in 1988, is the latest in our Race of My Life mini-series. I'm your host, Alex Kalanorkas, Autosport's Grand Prix editor, and with me today are two guests. The first is Autosport's chief editor and Race of My Life podcast regular, Kevin Turner. Kev, how are you?
Very good, thank you. Yeah, I'm a bit of a closet Rick Mears fan, so I'm looking forward to this one.
Excellent. Yeah, well, I'm sure you'll be cheering on rather than hiding that away, I'm sure. My second guest that I'm delighted to say is Gordon Kirby, who produced that original feature for Autosport magazine back in 1988 and quite literally wrote the book on Mears. Gordon, how are you, first of all, and welcome to the Race of My Life podcast.
I'm very well. It's a pleasure to be here and a pleasure to talk about Rocket Rick Mears.
Absolutely. Well, that already off to an excellent start with this. Well, I just wondered, Gordon, sort of if we can start off talking specifically about that race at Michigan. You know, can you give us a sort of summary of how the events unfolded? I know it was the second IndyCar race at that track that year. How did it all go down, as it were?
Yeah, they used to run two races, a 500-mile race in midsummer, and then this 150-mile race in the fall. I think it was called the Detroit News Grand Prix. You know, Rick was in his prime during these years. He had won his first Indy 500. He'd won his first championship, going for his second championship. Mario, too, obviously, was in his prime, having won the world championship in 1978 and was also doing a great deal of IndyCar racing during that period of time with Penske for a number of years. And then he had just switched over to Pat Patrick in 1981. So the race took shape. Mario was leading the race and Rick was chasing him. And Rick noticed that Mario's car towards the end of a fuel load would get a little loose, a little oversteery, if you will. So he reckoned that the thing for him to do here was just to pressure him in particular in the latter half of the run. To try to make the car looser and looser. He figured that would give him an opportunity to pass. And sure enough, going into the last lap, it happened. He'd been working him, pushing him hard. Mario was getting looser and looser. And he was able to finally dive down. Mario got loose enough and got a little bit wide so that Rick was able to dive down underneath him, take the car below him, pull ahead, and just edge ahead and just win on the last lap. And just as he says in the thing, you know, to win a race on the last lap is any driver's dream, and to beat one of your heroes. And Mario truly was one of his heroes at the time. Rick was a very humble guy, is a very humble guy. Anyway, those were the elements that made it all come together that made it a very special race for him at that time. He did go on to win some other races that had equal importance, but this one always is very warm to his heart to this day.
Well, one of the things I like about this one, quite apart from the fact, as you say, it's passing Mario Andretti on the last lap. I think he told you, Gordon, that he knew that his car could work really, really well low down, a really low groove on that day. But when he was closing in on Mario, he didn't want to give that away too much. So he said he sort of maybe stayed slightly higher up the lane, as it were, to begin with, until he was right there, not to give anything away to Mario. So really get the impression, it's a good example of Mears being a very thinking driver. He's very on top of things and had a plan. It wasn't all just reaction. It was ahead of the game, wasn't it?
No, you're exactly right, Kevin, on every single point that you make there. That is exactly what he did. He had, as you say, he knew his car was very, very good low down. Again, Rick is one of the coolest headed, as well as extremely cool guy, an extremely cool headed guy, one of the most cool headed race drivers I've ever met, you know, in my entire career. And just a delightful guy, very humble guy, as I said before, as he is today. And he was one of the most analytical race car drivers, you know, that I've ever known. And it kind of a seat of the pants thing, you know, rather than something that was really engineering driven. Although, you know, of course, he continues with the team to this day, some 25 years after he retired, working with the team and the drivers and the engineers to help them set the car up, because he is so good, so analytical, and able to simplicate things and to bring things back down to the basics of what you're dealing with. And that is Rick Mears. So yes, you are entirely right in your assessment of him. And, you know, he is at the top of the list in my view, in the entire world of a history of motor racing, in terms of being that kind of a driver, you know, very much a Fangio-like driver, if you will, I would say.
When we interviewed him in 2017, one of the things that he said, again, as you say, sort of self-deprecating characters, like, well, I was lazy, so I always tried to get the car working for me so that the car could do all the work. But that's what the great drivers do, isn't it? I mean, that's actually very sort of Alain Prost-like. He didn't have this huge need to be in the lead at the end of the first lap, didn't have to charge his way to the front instantly. He had the confidence and the intellect to just make sure he was in the ballpark during the race and gradually make sure he was in the right place at the right time. I think I'm right in saying he won quite a lot of his races with relatively late charges. He didn't waste energy unnecessarily getting involved in early scraps.
This goes back actually to his youth. You know, when he started racing, you know, his father was an off-road racer. Rick and his brother Roger, they raced motorcycles on the dirt, and then they did all kinds of off-road racing and so forth. And Rick was the younger brother. And Roger, you know, was a really, really hard worker in terms of, you know, building the cars and so forth, and a very aggressive, hard racer as well. And Rick came along. Rick was, he would help out on the cars and this and that, and he would be useful. But he wasn't the same motivated guy in terms of working on the cars as his brother Roger was. But, you know, as time went on, it just became clear to Roger that Rick was better than him, you know, and so it was. And it was this very, very cool, very almost detached attitude, just enjoying the whole darn thing. Again, just a remarkable guy all around. And when you talk about him, you know, again, you look at the list of the lap leaders at the Indy 500, where he's a four-time winner, he's not even in the top 10 of the all-time lap leaders. And that says this very thing, as you were saying, that he would size it up. He wasn't about trying to win the race early on. It was about being there at the end, having the car exactly right for those conditions, which is what he did at 1981 Indy 500, and he did it in many, many other instances. 1988, when he won his third Indy 500, was a classic. He had some problems with the car. He had to sort it out, had it really, really dialed in. He almost got a lap down at one point in 88 and had it completely dialed in at the end. And then the 1991 Indy 500 is an all-time classic in that way, when he beat Michael Andretti at the end. Maybe we'll talk about that one separately or just shortly.
I was going to say, just that those that perhaps aren't so familiar with Rick Mears' career, we should point out that it wasn't a lack of raw pace, though, was it? Because he also had six poles at the Indy 500. So it wasn't just that he would... he basically had all the assets to the game, didn't he? It just didn't have that Gilles Villeneuve, I must lead every lap sort of thing. So, yeah, I thought it was worth pointing out they had the six poles as well. I think the six poles is still a record, isn't it?
It is a record, and it probably will stand all time. And I think he also has five other front row starts. So he was on the front row, you know, 11 of his, I think, 15 Indy 500 starts. But he was a brilliant qualifier. The best I've ever seen, all in all. Johnny Rutherford used to be superb in the 70s in the big turbo boost McLaren days. But Rick was a special case. And he earned his nickname, you know, Rocket Rick, because of that exact thing. You know, my God, he could just produce these superb laps. They were beautiful to watch. And you know, it just got everybody's attention, you know, when you saw the speed.
Now, Kev, obviously, well, we've done a lot of these podcasts now, and we like to consider the way the victory is won, or perhaps the reasons that a driver is given for choosing a particular race. And what I really like about this one is when you've got a driver who's got four Indy 500 wins, four wins in one of the biggest motor races in the world, and to pick this one because it was how he dreamed it when he was younger, and he'd imagined doing something like that to a hero of his or a famous driver, the last gasp. I really enjoy that. The thinking that's gone into this pick, because I think I'm personally of the belief that the human stories of motor racing are just as interesting, maybe even more interesting than the cars and the actual racing action. I just find things like that fascinating. So, Kev, what do you think this says about Mears's character? And then, Gordon, if we could bring you in on that as well, that this is the race that he picked rather than at one of the Indy 500 successes or you know, championship clinching races as we've seen other drivers choose.
As you say, a lot of the drivers we speak to, they get not necessarily tempted, because obviously it's, you know, it's just another way of looking at it, but they often will go for the one that is the championship clincher. It would have been very easy for Mears to pick an Indy 500 win, and it's, you know, he had some good ones. And it wasn't just ovals; he did win on all sorts of circuits. It's he's sort of known as a kind of an oval Indy specialist, but actually he was rather more than that. So he could have chosen anything, and I think it's kind of. Shows that he can sort of cut all that out and go, well, what was the thing that gave me sort of the greatest personal satisfaction? And it's a race. It's not just, you know, some people pick a drive that where they dominate because it's a kind of a that's where they reach their peak in terms of pure driving. But other people kind of like to pick a wheel-to-wheel ding-dong. And kind of Mears has almost picked the ultimate one of that with, you know, passing... if you were making a list of the greatest IndyCar drivers of all time, Mario Andretti would be one of the first names going on the list. You can see why Mears really enjoyed the competition and element of beating him so late on, in a way that so tallied with the way he approached all his races anyway.
And also, it's interesting, Gordon, you were speaking about sort of Mears's analytical character and the way he would approach his racing and setting up the cars as well. That comes across in the Race of My Life feature, where he talks about, he says, oh, Mario thinks it was the wing plate that meant the car got loose on the final lap. But I was watching it, and yes, it was coming apart, but that's not the reason why he lost. I just think that's that level of detail at that speed with that amount of pressure on to win a race at the last is just tremendous.
No, that is Rick. As I said before, he was one of the most analytical and coolest race drivers I've ever met in my life. There's no question about it. Just a couple of other points here. When, you know, Kevin says he won in different kinds of tracks. You know, the ovals was where he was absolutely superb and supreme. But he was very, very good otherwise. In 1984, of course, he had a terrible accident. He was battling with Mario for the championship that year. He had won the Indy 500. And in practice at Sanair, an 0.8-mile tri-oval in Quebec, what they really should have never raced Indy cars at, but they did for a few years. And Rick, in the opening practice session, and he admitted he got too aggressive. He was battling Mario for the championship. He was a few points ahead. He reckoned he could do extremely well at this track. And he went out there and he got too aggressive too soon and got into a collision in traffic with a couple of slower cars, crashed into the inner wall, and smashed his feet. And everybody thought that was the end of his career. And Dr. Terry Trammell saved his feet. And it was a tough period of rehabilitation. He came back the next year. He actually won the Pocono 500 in 1985. That was his first win after, and his first the full 500 he was able to run. And his feet were completely bloodied. You know, it was very difficult for him to get out of the car. So the damage to those feet made street racing in particular very difficult for him for the rest of his career. And to a degree, road racing. But in 1989, I believe it was, he won at Laguna Seca, a classic American road course. And that's a race that really was very, very fulfilling to him, because he demonstrated to everybody, yeah, he was just as good. as anybody, you know, on road courses as well. And then let's go to the 1991 Indy 500. His fourth win, when he beat Michael Andretti in a fantastic duel. And I would say that now, you know, this was, we did this race of his life before. It's the victory over Mario, the last lap win over Mario, because that was such a classic Rick Mears race. Michael led most of that race. Rick was there chasing him, but not terribly close. And Michael really thought he had that race won. And it was a classic Rick Mears thing. He got the car dialed in oval track racing. You know, the track conditions change according to the weather. And as you get more rubber down, it's very, very critical and so forth. And the track conditions can change substantially. So the driver has to be able to mess with the car, make little changes on every pit stop and dial it in so that it's in perfect condition to suit those conditions. Again, that was an area where Rick was just, you know, superb, as good as anybody. So he did. He had his car dialed in for the conditions at the end of the race. On the final restart, he made this. Michael was leading. Rick was behind him. And he made this fantastic restart and passed Michael on the outside. The entire, in turn one, the entire grandstand in turn one just leapt to their feet, cheering, and everybody did around the entire track. And away he went. Michael could never, you know, he beat Michael by, I think, 3 or 4 seconds. He just went away, set his fastest laps of the race during that segment of the race. And it was just classic Rick Mears all around. Beautifully done, superbly done, a magnificent pass that everybody was there that day will remember forever. My good friend Nigel Roebuck was there. Ian Young was sitting in the grandstands in turn one. And I remember those were both, you know, classic moments for them in their careers of covering racing. So that was a classic win. And Michael, to this day, does not understand what happens. That was my race. I was supposed to win it, you know. And part of them, sometimes he says, somehow those guys, Mears and those guys, they cheated the valve at the end. You know, they had more boost, you know. But it wasn't straightaway speed. You know, he had the straightaway speed, obviously, because he had the speed in the corners. But a brilliant win, a superb win.
Well, I know that he said before that, because he had his first accident at Indianapolis in practice, didn't he, in that year, 1991. I don't think he'd ever crashed there before. And he said that it had hurt one of his ankles. And at one point,
broken a bone is quoted as saying. So, he, you know, really did some damage.
Yeah, no, that is correct. You're right. And he drove a good deal of the race with his left foot on top of his right foot, you know. Not wanting to use it because it was so painful and weakened. Exactly correct. So there's that element to it as well, Kevin.
That's just incredible. And then I'm not sure what's more incredible, driving like that for most of the Indy 500, using your left foot to push your right foot down, or then going into a shootout with the guy that set the pace for most of the race and deciding that now you're going to use your right foot and to hell with the pain, the adrenaline's pumping. I mean, it's just a phenomenal human performance. But I also wonder if, because I did watch the footage recently of that race, Michael actually did, early in the race, Michael went around the outside of Mears, just a little bit before Mears did it back to him. And I wonder if it was almost, I'm not going to have it. I'm going to come back and I'm really going to do it to respond and go back around the outside within a lap or two. Just an incredible performance, really. And I know that when you interviewed him, Gordon, when he retired, because obviously the Race of My Life interview was before that race. It was in 1988. So this maybe gives us a little bit of leeway to have a nice debate. I know that when you interviewed him when he retired, that he picked out those two races, 81 Michigan and 91 Indy. Which one do you rate the most, or did you enjoy the most?
Well, the 91 Indy 500, you can't, you know, we put it all into perspective here, you know, a superb win at the end of the race, beating a guy who was at the top of his of game, having his car perfectly set up, having some serious physical problems that you had to deal with to overcome, you know, the whole thing. It's an incredible story, an incredible combination of things. The Mario win, again, was a great thing to see, and it was great for Rick. You know, but the 91 Indy 500 is just an all-time classic, and it was his fourth Indy 500 win on top of all that, you know.
I must admit, it ticks a lot of my boxes, that one, I have to say.
Jay, you know, going back to the 1982 Indy 500, where he finished second to Gordon Johncock, where famously, at the last pit stop, Mr. Penske, made a bit of a tactical error, and they overfilled the car. They held him a little bit too long in the pits. So Johncock led him by about 7 or 8 seconds, and he chased him down. This was 1982, and again he made his attempt to pass Rick. He caught Rick up and tried to pass him in turn one, and he should have waited another lap. It was with 2 laps to go, and you know, he always says he made that mistake. Johncock was a very hard racer, and he blocked him, you know, fairly so, and so forth. And Rick had to get out of it, and he just didn't have the momentum to come back up in case of and he finished second and so forth. And I'll always remember, maybe 10 minutes after that race, somehow how this transpired, I can't remember. But my old friend and colleague, Robin Miller of the Indianapolis Star, and I encountered Rick in the men's room in the old gasoline alley. And we had about a 5 or 10 minute conversation with him about it. And I'll just always remember him saying, man, I messed up. How could I have made that mistake? You know, that was just not Rick Mears. He was too aggressive and too overanxious, a rare occasion.
Well, I know that
he learned from dramatically.
Well, I know that he got a bit of criticism from some of the other people like AJ Foyt sort of said, oh, he should never have backed out into the first corner. You know, I'd have stayed there. And I know that Rick's argument was, first of all, I don't believe that he would have done, because Foyt didn't win all the races he won by charging into city spaces, and it would have been a crash. And he said the reason he got caught out was because previously in the race, when he'd done that move, he'd been able to pull out the toe and go by. But because of the extra fuel, he kind of hit a bit of a wall, and they kind of went into turn one together, and he decided to back out of it. So he thought that the Foyt criticism was rather unfair, but he did say, as you say, that if he could use hindsight, he'd go back and just do the run a lap later, stay there a lap longer. And because I think he was actually in front on the line, wasn't he? Was he just ahead, I think, or very, very much close?
No, he was a little bit behind. He never got quite up to with him. Yeah. And he, you know, again, what he should have left it until half a lap later, until turn three, you know, there's no question in his mind that what he should have done. He could have done it. And again, Foyt's comment, it's just Foyt being Foyt, needling him a little bit, you know, because here's this other guy who's just won 4 races, Indy 500s now, and so forth. So
just to go off on a very random tangent, I have an amusing anecdote of discussing an issue that George Russell, the current Williams Formula One driver, had during his GP3 round at Hungary a few years ago, which also took place in the toilets. It was just a random encounter, and I was like, okay, we'll catch up later. So Kev, can you complete the set? Can you make us the third person to have had a conversation with a racing driver in a toilet?
I passed Lewis Hamilton in a toilet during F1 testing, but I didn't decide. I thought that wasn't a good moment to try and have an interview with him, to be honest.
No, I think you'd have had a press officer chasing after you if you'd done that.
I once found Nick Tandy crying in a toilet. I don't know whether that counts, but that's a story for another day. He had better days to come, so I'm sure he won't mind me mentioning that.
No, absolutely. Well, we must get back to the topic at hand and as quick as we can. So I wondered, any more of Mears's, because he's got four of them, any more of the Indy 500 successes that you think would be worthy of being up there in the Race of My Life discussion?
Well, his very first win, of course, he was that year, ground effects were coming into IndyCar racing. And Penske had a brand new car, the PC7. And Bobby Unser had joined the team. And Bobby was a veteran, highly experienced guy. And he was a renowned tester. Rick and Bobby were very dissimilar characters. Bobby was just a hard driving guy. And he really couldn't understand Rick. When Rick thought he's lazy. He's never going to be, you know, a top runner, and there was Rick, you know, racing with him, beating him, and so forth. And it kind of, it was the challenging thing for Bobby, because he was so, they were so different, and so dissimilar. But so Bobby had the PC7, the new ground effect car, very well developed, and it was the fastest car. And Bobby really wanted that car, and it was his car in his mind. He had put so much development time into it. Rick decided that he really didn't understand the car as well as he would like, so he stayed with the previous year's car, a PC6, which was not a ground effect car and not quite as quick as Uncle Bobby's car. So he ran along. Bobby led most of the race, but near the end of the race, Bobby actually stripped top gear and had to finish the race running in third gear. So he fell down the field, and Rick was running along closely behind him, inherited the lead, and won the race. But again, it was good, really cagey, correct thinking. You know, I'm not sure that this car, this other car, it's too new, but I know this car, the PC6, and sure enough. And there it was. That was his first win, and only his second Indy 500. And he was showing that kind of smarts and so forth. And of course, he went on to win the championship that year, and won three championships, you know, over the next 4 years. And then, of course, during that time as well, I should point out, it's well known that Bernie Ecclestone approached him. Bernie was owning the Brabham team at the time, about coming Formula One. And he did two tests in the Brabham F1 car, and took him a little while to kind of realize how aggressive you had to be in a Formula One car. He said, "I had to get myself mad," and then he really got with it, and he got with the speed, and he was right there. And you know, Bernie offered him a deal, and he decided at the time that you know, CART was really coming together, and you had, you know, the big ovals and street courses and the whole thing, and he was with Penske Racing. He decided, you know, he loved this whole thing that he was doing so much, and he didn't want to go and tackle the Formula One thing. So, you know, Rick Mears was lost to Formula One for that. Herbie Blash, who, of course, worked for Bernie at the time, he and Charlie, Herbie always used to say, you know, when he was working for the FIA later on, about how that was the big loss for America for Formula One, how Rick was Mr. Cool, California, and how good he was and how excited they were that he was going to come and drive for them. But unfortunately, it didn't happen.
I feel quite mixed about that, because on the one hand, obviously, it would have been fantastic for him to have been in Formula One, and I think he would have done a really good job. But on the other hand, it's, first of all, he still had a great career. It was a very astute move, really, to stay there. And also, it's very easy for things to go wrong in F1, and the decisions are made very quickly. And then we saw with Michael Andretti when he came across, things didn't work out. You know, he didn't show how good a driver he was when he went to McLaren in 1993. So, perhaps it was a clever move to stay with probably the greatest American racing team in a championship that was up and coming. I guess it's the same sort of argument for the whole Joseph Newgarden thing. People will say, "Oh, your Newgarden should come to F1," but why would you leave Penske and everything that you know there to take a risk and potentially not be in a competitive F1 car?
No, that's exactly correct. I agree on the Newgarden front as well. You know, and as Joseph says, you know, unless I can get an opportunity with Ferrari, Mercedes, or Red Bull, one of the top teams, I wouldn't even consider leaving Penske. So it's the same thing there with Rick. You know, he did have, you know, America's greatest racing team, you know, and look at the career that he went on to have as it unfolded, you know, all those Indy 500 wins and championships and the reputation he built for himself. And then he built a career for himself beyond racing, didn't he? Because when he retired, Roger offered him this job that he has today, and he's still there with the team and still has a big involvement with it. You know, and guys like Newgarden and Pagenaud, they really appreciate, you know, Rocket Rick Mears and what he brings to the table, because he teaches them things to this very day.
And he certainly wouldn't be working for Brabham now, would he? So if he'd made that move. So I think that was probably the correct career choice.
Nor would he have wanted to go on and be an FIA official or something like that. So he's in the right place for himself. No question about it.
Absolutely. Well, I mean, it was really interesting listening to, Kev, you mentioned that Autosport podcast appearance that Rick Mears made back in 2017, ahead of that Indy 500 where Fernando Alonso had come over for the first time. And it's interesting listening to our colleague from motorsport.com, David Malsha Lopez, saying he considers Rick Mears to be the Alain Prost of IndyCar. Gordon, would you agree with that assessment? And Kev, do you think that was a fair comment there?
No, absolutely. It's a very, very good, very good comment. Kevin had mentioned that before, comparing him to Prost. So, no, very, very much so. You know, a little bit different personality, obviously, you know, outside of the car, but in terms of the way they approach racing and so forth, very similar. And again, I'll go back to my comparison earlier to Fangio. You know, Rick is very, very much in that category. And he's also just a wonderful guy. He's a great guy, great human being. You know, he, in fact, in my book with him at the end of it, he discussed after he retired, he got into a little bit of a problem with drinking, you know, and so forth. And that realized that he had a bit of an alcoholism problem, and he dealt with it and fought it and so forth. And he talked about it very, very frankly in the book. And when we did release that book in 2008, we did maybe 6 or 8 book signings at various races across the country. And I was intrigued because at many of those book signings, every one of them, at least one person came up to him and had a very quiet personal conversation with Rick. And it turns out this was somebody who had had an alcohol problem. And Rick had, you know, they had reached out, and Rick would give people his phone number, his cell number, and say, call me, you know, anytime. And he would have a conversation with them and help them out and that kind of thing. So that's just kind of a measure of the kind of a human being he is. And again, he would never ask for any accolades or awards for that. It was completely an off-the-record, you know, personal thing. You know, again, to me, that's the indication of a really first-class human being.
And is it true that he, while we're on the sort of drink-related subject, but a happier one, is it true that the bottle of milk that he won at the first Indy 500, he sort of managed to let go, but a fan sort of showed it to him years later and he ended up buying it or something? Is that a true, have you heard that before?
I think you're right about that. I can't tell you the exact specifics about that, but I do believe that that is, your general story is quite right, yes.
I like that. I like that little attention to detail, because everyone thinks of trophies and things like that, but the milk bottle, I think that's a nice touch to that.
No, sure it is. It is, absolutely.
Well, at least he went on to get more milk in the subsequent years. It was not like he missed his one opportunity. That's good. Guys, I mean, any more races that we might throw into the pot for a sort of debate about Meehan's race of my life, or considering ones that are nearly there but perhaps not quite?
I think we've covered, you know, the ones that there are no other ones that really, really stand out. You know, there was, they used to race Indy cars in the early 80s at Atlanta, you know, the 1.5 mile high banked oval. And boy, was that was an impressive place. And he was unbeatable there. Boy, my God. Again, he had a couple of duels with Mario and with Uncle Bobby Unser. You know, it was just very, you know, when he pulled off those wins, boy, it was just he was so impressive. Again, so smooth, so precise, you know, just right on the money. And never once in his career, you know, did Rick have any problems with any other drivers, any squabbles. He never did anything bad to anybody on the track. He was a completely fair driver all the way down the line, and everybody, you know, had respect for him. I mean, it sounds a little bit glib and anodyne to say, but it's 110% true. And there aren't too many race car drivers or sportsmen of any kind that you can say that about them, that their career was completely, essentially, you know, error-free, and they were complete sportsmen all the way through it.
Absolutely. Well, I think we've arrived at the time, the regular time in the Race of My Life podcast, where I have to sort of make a strange judgment of whether I agree with the great champion that has made this pick for the race of their life, or perhaps that, you know, there was an alternative that we've discussed that we can go through. And I think, although I really love the feature, and it's really insightful. It's really interesting to hear his thoughts on how he dreamed of that, taking a big moment. I mean, it's like, to use another sporting comparison, it's like a kid dreaming of scoring, you know, a 93rd minute winner in the Football World Cup final or something, or scoring a winning touchdown at the end of the Super Bowl or something like that. I think that's really, really cool. But I think, I mean, and correct me if I'm wrong here, but I think, Gordon, maybe you agree with me that maybe the 1991 Indy 500 just about trumps it for the sheer spectacle, the pass, you know, getting the battle with Michael Andretti, but also to do that in intense agony when you've had to cross your legs and push one foot down with the other. I mean, no one really can even conceivably think about doing that at any point. So perhaps that just edges it. But of course, with the greatest of respect to the fact that his Race of My Life pick was Michigan 1981. Do you think that's okay?
I think it's okay. I think I agree with you. There's no two ways about it. All-time classic win in the history of automobile racing, isn't it? The more we've looked at it here and looked at all of the details and everything that was involved. So, obviously, to beat Mario Andretti on the last lap with a superb, well-timed, perfectly passed is also something that goes down in the books. But again, the 1991 Indy 500. And when you add the fact that it was his fourth and it turned out to be, you know, his last win, it was something very, very special and very much for the books.
Well, every now and again, you see or read about a race that reminds you that these people are on a sort of slightly different plane to us sort of normal people. And for me, that's one of those that, I mean, actually, I think he's come back after the San Air crash after 84. He's also one of the great motorsport comebacks, probably. But yeah, the 91 performance, just, I think he's one of those moments where you go, I just don't see how you can do that, really. So I think I would also get my vote, but I also, as you say, Alex, I quite like the Michigan race as well, because an Indy 500 is an obvious choice.
Absolutely. No, it's good to get all these differences in, especially when, you know, they're offering different ways of thinking about why a race is important and stuff like that. But I think I've thoroughly enjoyed this chat, but let's wrap up the podcast here. Gordon, it's been fantastic to have you on as a guest, and thank you very much. And, you know, if you ever are in contact with Rick, do pass on our best. And yeah, thanks for all the great memories.
I will send Rick your best whenever I see him next. I'm not quite sure when that's going to be in the environment we're in, but hopefully I'll see him at the Indy 500 that we'll run this year. And I will tell him we had this fine conversation.
He's welcome to join us for another podcast whenever he wants as well. He's a fantastic,
I'd be happy to do
a fantastic
it, you know,
interview.
He's a great guy, a great human being, and you can always learn so much. He's got many great stories, and he can tell you a lot about racing today as well. No two ways about it. His finger is on the ball still.
Well, he still spots, doesn't he? He's been a spotter for many years for a lot.
Yeah,
of
yeah, no, he's a spotter for them, and he's, you know, he's in the engineering. He has a seat in the engineering office, and he's part of the discussion with the drivers and the engineers about the setup. He knows exactly what's going on, and you know, they rely on him a great deal. He knows exactly what he's talking about still to this day, and he's just got such great wisdom. And, you know, such a great, cool attitude, you know, what a race driver should be all about.
Well, Roger Penske has, I think it's fair to say, has a knack for picking the right people to have in his team. So I think the fact that he's had Rick for, well, it's four decades, isn't it? If you include the driving and what he's done afterwards, is probably a pretty ringing endorsement, really.
Well, it is a ringing endorsement, isn't it? Because Roger is the number one guy in American racing and one of the greatest in the world in terms of what he's achieved as a businessman as well, and way beyond racing. And Rick's tenure with him has got to be unprecedented in the history of motor racing. I don't believe there's a driver who has spent most of his entire career at the top level with him and then went on to have a secondary career, you know, with a team, and is still an essential part of the team, as you say, 40 years on.
Absolutely. Well, guys, Gordon, thank you again. Thank you very much for joining us, and Kev as well. Thank you. Always good to have you on the Race of My Life podcast. And I do urge everyone to go to autosport.com and check out, you can read the full feature, Rick Mears, all his thoughts on Michigan 1981. Check that out. Let us know what you think on our social media channels using the handle @autosport. So once again, guys, thank you very much. And thank you to you for listening. We'll be back soon with another episode of Race of My Life.